understand that a number of the committees are still busy with their budgetary review and recommendation reports. I had discussions also with the social cluster chairpersons. However, they are still continuing with their reports, busy finalizing it. Some of them may join us as we go along, and I sincerely hope that more members from the economics cluster will join us. Just to give you some background to this briefing that will be taking place is that I think all of us are aware of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Council and the work that they are doing and overseeing. And there's been a number of requests from chairpersons, honourable ministers in the economic cluster to say that, but we need a briefing and we want to find out a little bit more. So we thought it prudent, in consultation of course with your office, that we arrange one briefing for all the committees to be brought up to speed to the same level, and then thereafter, if need be, further interaction can take place with the different committees. I had discussions with Minister Patel on the briefing and the format that it would that it will take, and he has also kindly agreed to bring other ministers and deputy ministers with, who are part of the collective effort in executing this responsibility that has been given to them. I would say, honourable ministers and deputy ministers, it's long overdue that we have something like this, and we, from the side of my office at least, in the Speaker's office, make a commitment that we get quarterly briefings on the work that has been taking place, so that we can also not share it with members of Parliament, but generally with the public, because the work that's been done is supposed to improve the lives of all people and to grow the economy. And it's important for the people to be aware what their representatives are doing and what the government are doing in executing this task that has been given to them. The lead presentation will be done by Minister Patel, the Minister of Economic Development. I will hand it over to him, and he will then, as he goes through the presentation, then call upon the other colleagues. Minister Quinty is here, Deputy Minister Cronin, Deputy Minister Masuka that is here. I hope I have not left anyone out. And afterwards we'll then have interaction with the presenters on the presentation that has been made, and there can also be an opportunity for questions of clarity. Honourable Fatane, why are you looking so in a pensive mood to me? I can report that since I saw you the last time, the South African rugby bit is in, and we are waiting the outcome of that process. The technical committee will report back. But for now, and this is where this presentation is actually very important, because it all points into one direction that we want to achieve as a country, that we don't necessarily do this just to host big events, but essentially to grow the economy and to improve the lives of our people.
That's why I was at Newlands on Saturday to support the box. I shouted like anything. I didn't deserve to be in the presidential seat. They don't shout there. But I shouted just to make sure that we score the point.
It's changing times. These days you shout in the presidential suite as well if it's necessary. Now, honourable members, I would then like to hand over to the honourable Minister Patel, who will take us through the presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. And may I start by just officially introducing the team that's accompanying me. Seated on my left in all respects is the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform. But he's here today, and I will explain it a little bit later. He's also the Chairperson of the Management Committee of the PICC. And so in this capacity, we did a drawing of straws, and I drew the short straw, so I had to do the presentation today. And then on my right is the Deputy Minister of Economic Development, Deputy Minister Masuku, and on his right, unusually, is the Deputy Minister of Public Works, Deputy Minister Cronin. Oh yes, that's true. Perspective is everything in life. And they both here as members of the PICC Secretariat. And I'll explain that structure when we come to it. I also have the Director General of the Economic Development Department, DG Tom, present, as well as a team of the hard-working PICC staff that has attended. And by way of the introduction, Honorable Frolic, as chair of the committees in Parliament, had asked that in this first session, we should really introduce the PICC and the work of the PICC. And it was a challenge for the management committee that met last night to think what do we focus on in what is an enormous body of work that the PICC does. And we decided that we will probably have a mixed audience with some honorable members who will know quite a lot about the work of the PICC. Some have had a privileged peek in under the bonnet. For example, I don't see the Deputy Speaker. Is he right behind me? Always right there backing. But he's been part of that process. And then there are other members of Parliament that perhaps may not know as much. So we're going to try to combine a little bit of an introduction to the PICC with a little bit of substance to illustrate the work we do. And then, of course, in future sessions, we would be able to amplify, perhaps select a couple of themes and work on them. There will be a few other colleagues that may join us in the course of the proceedings. Their annual reports and BRRR-related processes permitting. So, Jefferson, with that introduction, and thanks for the opportunity, and you're right, not a moment too soon. It's very important that we have this moment to be able to account for our work and to take the guidance that comes from the engagement with members of the legislature. And in the report which we've just circulated, we're going to deal with some background, some reflections on the work of the PICC, and a concluding remark or two. By way of background, infrastructure is absolutely critical to development. It's important for all sorts of reasons. We've identified a few. It's the foundation for long-term growth. Look at any fast-growing, sustainably growing society, and you see the underpinnings of it is infrastructure. It's critical for economic performance. Without any question, businesses, investors, look at the state of infrastructure. They need energy, transport, logistics, communication, water. But they also need the skills that flow from the education infrastructure and a healthy workforce that the medical infrastructure provides. It's the key to service delivery for obvious and clear reasons. It supports many industries, so its economic footprint is larger than its direct work, construction, steel, cement manufacturers, but also key professions from engineering and the artisanal trade. And so infrastructure is a major creator of employment. It stimulates local industrialization and technology innovation because it buys goods and services in the economy. It, in the South African context, can be a key driver to reverse the special geography and economics of apartheid. It can promote balanced development. It can unlock economic opportunities, promote mineral extraction and beneficiation, and support rural inclusion and development. It is one more opportunity to promote broad-based empowerment in the society, job creation, youth employment. And then above all, given where South Africa wishes to play in the global stage, it is the fundamental driver of regional economic integration, more in our case than any regulatory regime. So having made the point, which I think all members of Parliament would take as givens, we next want to share some reflections on the background to the work of the PICC. So we've periodized this, just for matter of convenience, in a pre-94 and a post-94, and then we break that up a bit. So pre-94, we make the point that infrastructure wasn't incidental to the political economy. It reinforced apartheid systems. So we had the obvious thing, excellent infrastructure for some, exclusion of the majority. Townships that were built away from centers of employment, so breaking with a global pattern where residents and economic activity are broadly integrated. Homelands as a special parking slot for what was regarded as surplus labor. And all of this had infrastructure components to it. Townships were underdeveloped and largely without critical infrastructure. For example, we ran an energy surplus at a time when more than half the population lived without electricity. And one important statistic that I'll pick up later is, at the time of the transition to democracy, and we take 1996 as the key year because it's the first census year, 5.2 million houses were connected to the energy grid. Come back to that a little bit later. But as infrastructure deprived South Africans of access to opportunity, protest grew against the system. And as protest grew against the system, more money was shifted to military and security, and you can see that very clearly, as we'll show in a moment, and that led to a decline in infrastructure spending in the latter years of apartheid, right up to 1994. Here's a way of illustrating the storyline. And if honorable members were to look at the screen there, you'll see between 74, these are five-year buckets of spending. It's in 2012 rands. You'll see in the period 74 to 79, in that period, infrastructure spending remains constant. Then it dips in the early 80s right through to the transition to democracy. You see the downward trend in spending. And this is in a period of rapid urbanization and population growth. Post-1994, what's the story? So initially, for a number of years, the preoccupation post-1994 is on consolidating the institutions of democracy, opening the economy, and focusing on social policies, social infrastructure, and social welfare. So it was the creation of the new parliament, the judiciary, the provinces, the new municipal systems. But recall what then happens. We're changing the institutions to ensure all South Africans participate, but the very delivery systems for infrastructure also get changed in the process. Opening the economy, labor market is reformed, workers have statutory rights. Trade policy reform, we have the liberalization of trade, competition laws are introduced, state-owned entities like your ESCOMs and Transnets are increasingly corporatized. Each of these have this double consequence. They have a policy role, right or wrong, but they also have a consequence on infrastructure. And then there's the focus on social policies. Massively, the single biggest focus in the first democratic administration in infrastructure was on housing. The start of the RDP houses and the expansion of clinics, among others. Connecting townships to energy and water, increasing access to schools and universities, and de-racializing social grant payments. So let's see what happens then to spending. Going back to the graph here, you'll see a bit of a high point here, a dramatic decline in the latter decade of apartheid. And then in the first decade of the democratic era, it stabilized because resources and energies shift to other areas of changing the society. Now we give this little, before I click on it, it's a little graph or a little animated picture of Johannesburg, just showing a bit more graphically urbanization that is the backdrop to all this very significant political developments. So see Joburg in 1901, and we take the picture for about 110 years or so, or about 100 years. And you see there on the picture the growth of Joburg. And just see how it speeds up in this period. And this period begins to coincide with the transition to democracy. So, aside from the urbanization challenge, and just to recognize the Minister of Water and Sanitation, who's also a member of the management committee of the PICC, has arrived. So on the transport side, in the 60s to mid-80s, we were spending anything from 3 to 5% of GDP on transport. As the fiscus challenged to meet social spending and the inclusion of people, young people in schools and elsewhere, that was reduced from 1.5% to 2.5% of GDP. You see the freight rail significantly lower, road transport becomes key, the congestions in the cities, the fragmented development patterns, and the fact that today about 70% of the population spend up to a third of the income on transport. So that brings to an end, call it the second phase. A third phase commences with, the key words I'll use here is in the heading, but if I go straight to the bullet points, we have from the early 2000s strong economic growth, fueled by the commodity boom in the mid-2000s, and as the economy grows in that period, that the problems and the gaps in infrastructure becomes evident. As GISA is launched, at the same time the country makes a bid for the 2010 Soccer World Cup, and it succeeds and it undertakes to do significant infrastructure build. But of course they included the stadiums, but it was not only the stadiums. Sitting behind it was also transport infrastructure, like the airports. King Shaka was a new airport, but even the Joburg and Cape Town had massive revamps in that period. The Gauteng Highway, the GFIP, which is the main connecting line between Tshwane and Joburg, the Gautrain itself, tourism infrastructure, and a lot of work is done in this period on economic infrastructure. But it's not yet prioritized because the country dashes to meet the 2010 World Cup deadline for transport and stadium build. As soon as the Soccer World Cup is over, we recognize that the country was in recession. In fact, the recession was from 2009. And while we had recovered from the recession by the end of 2009, we were still in a phase of massive job shedding. Lost a million jobs in that crisis, in that jobs crisis caused by the global economic meltdown. Cabinet looks at this. By the end of 2010, it adopts the new growth path as an economic framework, which identified 10 jobs drivers, with infrastructure being the first and the trigger jobs driver. When the National Development Plan is finalized, it takes infrastructure again as an absolute centerpiece of the storyline around inclusive growth. So let's see what happens with spending now. In preparation for the World Cup and with the work that Asgisa put in, you see infrastructure spending lifting significantly in that five-year period. That then is the backdrop to the formation of the PICC. So we now, as Cabinet, there's a commitment to infrastructure. And we began to look at post-World Cup infrastructure. Did a situation analysis, saw many challenges. Coordination, lack of reliable data on our build program. Cabinet didn't have the tools to say, this is what's happening on this project. Lack of forward planning and integration challenges across the spheres and between different programs in government. And by July that year, 2011, the Cabinet Lekgotla sets up the PICC, Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, and at that stage it's a non-statutory body. We then did an initial mapping exercise, and that was used to put together the National Infrastructure Plan. Just to give a little flavor of it, we plotted the population of each of the provinces We looked at challenges of underdevelopment in the ex-homeland areas. We looked at a number of service delivery challenges from water to telephone access, sanitation, electricity. Looked at where were the main economic centers of the country, and you'll see it all in the map animated. Where was high population density? What was the constrained transport and where people were moving from areas of high population density but limited economic opportunity to areas of economic opportunity? And then overlaying that, we looked at the mining wealth of the country, the lack of service delivery, where new opportunities like renewable energy was located, and all of this helped to put together what eventually became the National Infrastructure Plan. The plan identified more than 300 projects in different stages of development. Some of them were just someone had a good idea, no technical work. Others were undergoing feasibility. Some were stuck with the regulatory approval. Perhaps there was an environmental impact assessment at provincial level and it never moved beyond the province. Some were ready for implementation. Plans were beautiful, but no funding. Some were under construction, and some were completed but not handed over because there was no operational budget or maintenance budget. So we did some work on the project pipeline to see how they connected, and we developed 18 strategic integrated projects called SIPs. These SIPs, which some honorable members will be familiar with, are an attempt to try to find the connections and the synergies between things. So let me illustrate with a few. SIP 1 is unlocking the Northern Mineral Belt with Waterberg as a catalyst. And essentially what we did here was we recognized enormous natural and human resources in parts of Limpopo, but a huge gap in infrastructure. And Cabinet and the PICC saw opportunities to invest in rail, water pipelines, energy generation and transmission infrastructure. We also saw urban development opportunities that Waterberg could become the major new urban development node in the country. And the opportunity with coal, platinum and other minerals would be enhanced if you could have rail lines, power supply and look at export port opportunities. So out of that, we then developed all the detailed plans, whether it was getting the Tawip Dam completed, whether it was building a water pipeline from the Mokolo Crocodile Rivers through to Lephalale, whether it was at that stage still very conceptual, getting the Medupi Build Program fast-tracked, building clinics in the area, road maintenance and new roads being built. That it's the collection of all those projects together that constituted the strategic integrated project. The second SIP was the Durban Free State Gauteng Logistics and Industrial Corridor. That's the main artery for fuel, for transport, and for freight between the external world and South Africa's economic heartland. The third SIP is the southeastern node and corridor development, which stretches from Nelson Mandela Bay right through past Buffalo City, and it would include the Entowakos Highway, the Msumfubu Dam, the development of a manganese sinter plant and a smelter plant, port and rail upgrades. All of those projects were brought together. SIP 4 was unlocking the economic opportunities in the Northwest Province. We looked at roads, rail, bulk water and water treatment, service tourism opportunities, beneficiation of minerals in Northwest. SIP 5, closer to Parliament, is the Saldanha Northern Cape Development Corridor, looking at unlocking opportunities on the West Coast. And some of what we see now in Saldanha, with port expansion, the industrial development zone, the gas infrastructure that's being built there was conceived in this period when the PICC was being formed. But it's also connecting the West Coast with Sishen in the Northern Cape and with other mining areas in the Northern Cape to try to develop Northern Cape itself. There were three energy SIPs. Green energy was an important part. At that stage, there was no new green energy yet, so it was really making the argument for green energy. SIP 9 was energy generation. Those are the big power stations like Medupi, Kusile, Ingula, and others. And SIP 10 was transmission and distribution of electricity. Next, we had a group of spatial SIPs. Just to illustrate, SIP 6 and SIP 7 dealt with all the municipalities. SIP 6 was the rural municipalities, the 23 poorest districts, covering 17 million South Africans, where there's enormous maintenance backlogs and limited access to facilities. But also SIP 7 was your main urban areas, the generators of wealth in the economy, and trying to ensure that we can manage an orderly process of urbanization. And SIP 11 covered agro-logistics and rural infrastructure. In other words, putting in place the branch train lines, the fencing systems at farms, irrigation schemes, processing facilities like an abattoir or a dairy, the aquaculture incubation schemes and so on to unlock opportunities in the rural areas. SIP 12 was revitalizing their health facilities, SIP 13 the National School Build Program, and SIP 14 higher education infrastructure. So these are all what you would call the human capital SIPs. SIP 16 and 15 and 16 were the knowledge-based SIPs. 15 was expanding access to ICT, broadband coverage, fiber optic rollout by the private sector, connecting schools to the internet. And SIP 16 is the SKA and Meerkat program in Carnarvon. SIP 17 was African regional integration, looking at bulk water resources, the Lesotho Highlands, which is essentially connecting water access, water supply in Lesotho with water demand in South Africa, transport, electricity, hydropower, and all of this would be complemented by the work on developing a free trade area. And then SIP 18 was a water and sanitation SIP that was subsequently added. By 2014, this non-statutory body became a statutory body. Parliament passed the Infrastructure Development Act, and it took the informal structures of the PICC, and it gave it some legal authority. The PICC itself, it consists of a council, which is made up of, it's chaired by the president, in the absence of the president, by the deputy president. It consists of a number of cabinet members, close to 20, so more than half of cabinet sits on it. It consists of all the premiers of all nine provinces, the metro mayors, and the leadership of SALGA. There's a management committee that is made up of a number of cabinet members, as well as two premiers that are nominated for this purpose, and a representative from SALGA. The PICC secretariat is made up of a smaller number of cabinet members and a number of deputy ministers, including the deputy ministers here today and a number of other deputy ministers, probably about eight or so deputy ministers, bringing all of the infrastructure knowledge of their departments together. There's also a SIP chair forum of executive authorities, and then each SIP has a coordinator. So Minister Nkwinti chairs the management committee of the PICC, and the Minister of Economic Development chairs the PICC secretariat. The focus of the PICC, what is its essential goal. If we had to break it down into activities, it identifies 5-year infrastructure priorities, does work on a 20-year project pipeline, looks at development objectives like empowerment, skills, localization, research and development. It looks at how to expand maintenance, improve infrastructure, links between the rural areas and ensuring that the poorest provinces are covered by adequate infrastructure. And so you see in the list, look at capacity constraints in the state, scaling up investment, addressing the impact of infrastructure prices, and promoting African regional integration. So, in a word, what is the PICC? It's the executive's tool for monitoring the implementation and impact of infrastructure on the economy. It can be used by a premier as a member of the executive in that province, by a metro mayor in a city, by the president across the country as that tool for monitoring. It's a planning and coordinating body. So in a way, we want to contrast, it's not a funding structure, so bids for infrastructure are not made in the first place to the PICC. It's not the accounting authority for the spending of money or the control of the bold program that remains with the departments that Parliament votes funds to, and it's not the implementing agent that department puts in charge of a bold program. The PICC has drawn lessons from our own experience of infrastructure starting from the 2010 World Cup and all the subsequent infrastructure programs. We've looked at problems of planning and integration, silos and the three spheres of government, the need for a pipeline of materials, your bitumen for the roads, cement, bricks, steel, but also the pipeline of skills, the number of artisans, engineers, project managers, and it looks at the local procurement throughout the value chain and technical project management skills in the public sector. So that's by way of the background to the PICC for the members who perhaps had not had this briefing previously, Chairperson. The next part that the team of colleagues have asked that we make a few remarks on is the work of the PICC. So on a progress report, you'd see if we track spending as an example, what the storyline now is, a significant increase in spending compared to the historical spending baselines, and that represents now the very purposive increase in infrastructure focus in our budget and in the work of public entities. But part of our work is not just to monitor spending, it's also to look at all the other impacts of infrastructure, because with infrastructure you're not just building things, the impact, the multiplier impact is enormous. So take infrastructure spending and the economy. Public investment has grown since 2008. The increase alone, not taking the baseline, just the increase has boosted real GDP by 2.2% by 2016. That's worth some 95 billion rand on our country annual bottom line. The commodity price plunge contributed to recessionary conditions in Nigeria, Russia and Brazil, all of which have a very similar economic profile. Without the increased infrastructure spending, the South African economy is likely to have gone into a deep recession in 2015. So our infrastructure spending helped to buoy the economy. And the multiplier effect of infrastructure spend over the next 3 years alone is estimated at about 302 billion rand annually in today's prices. On employment, we wanted to share with the committee the extent of the employment challenge. Let's compare 1996 to 2017, so 96 is the census year, so we've got some reliable data there, and 2017 is the latest data. In that 21 years, the population grew by 39%. But the working age population grew much faster, by 49%. Employment, the number of new jobs, grew faster than population. It grew by 77%. Some 7 million new jobs were added to the economy. But at the same time, the size of the labor force grew by 99%, resulting in 4 million more unemployed people. And that's the challenge that we face. Even though our jobs growth has outperformed population growth, you still have the unusual effect of a rise in unemployment. And how does one square that? Because intuitively it doesn't make sense. And the reason is an ever-increasing proportion of people aged between 15 and 64 who previously were not even looking for work. They were stuck in Lubala, in Lusikisiki, in the subsistence economy, unable to imagine that they could get a job in Nelson Mandela Bay or in Joburg. They now active economic citizens, sometimes unemployed. Many of them are unemployed, but they're looking for work, or they have found a job. And that's the pattern of the past that we just need to factor in. So we did a very interesting exercise. In 1996, only 45% of people of working age were in the labor force, 11 million people. By 2016, it was 60%, 22.3 million people. So here's the hypothetical we did. We said, if the labor force had grown at the same rate as population, 39%, we call it an ordinary country profile, what would have been the result today? If we had the same number of workers, it would have meant zero unemployment. In fact, we'd have had a labor shortage of 500,000 people. If the labor force grew at the same rate as the working age population, remember our demographics is like a pyramid, much larger number of young people, much smaller number of old people. Even if we grew at 49%, the labor force today would be 16.8 million, which means we would have had an unemployment rate of 4%, which by global standards would have been extraordinarily low. In reality, this is not the case. Our unemployment rate is very, very high, 27%. And that's just open unemployment. And what it points to is that job creation needs to exceed population growth significantly to keep unemployment rates at the same rate or to decrease them. Because an ever greater proportion of people who previously did not look for work are now entering the labor market. And I should then also indicate, Chairperson, that we've just been joined by another member of the PICC Secretariat, Deputy Minister Chikunga, who is an active member, and I see the Minister of Transport, who's on the Management Committee, has also joined us. Now, if we look at this administration alone, since the last general election, on the labor force side, we have an increase in jobs of about 1 million additional people who are working today compared to at the start of this parliament's life. The main gain has been in business services, but the second biggest gain has been in construction. But I should note that in this last quarter, we've also had a fairly sharp drop in construction jobs. But if you look at the overall trend line, that's the data there, by quarter, you'll see since April 2014, let's use it as the indicative date for the start of the new administration, we've had an increase of just over 200,000 construction jobs. That's an 18% increase over that period. Now, I've talked about jobs. I want to talk briefly about transformation. The work in infrastructures supported transformation through the development of black construction companies, black industrialists, local procurement, and new factories being set up. On black construction companies, we point to the settlement agreement with the construction industry, where the seven largest construction companies have agreed not only to pay 2.9 billion rand, but also to transform their ownership structures. Marion Roberts has sold its entire construction business to a black-owned company. As one example of what is happening in the top six, top seven, Avenge has sold 51% of economic interest in the company to a black, to a group of black South Africans. ArcelorMittal, if I move away from construction to steel making, has committed to not only strengthen investment in its own plants, but also to ensure that it deepens the BEE ownership in the company. Black industrialists, this is programs to bring black South Africans into making the widgets and the gadgets that go into the economy, some of it into infrastructure, pipes, valves, buses, foundries that that do molded products and structural steel, all of these. This numbers here comes indicates the level of commitment from 2013 in funding for black empowered and black owned companies. If you look at this, the graph on the left, what's really interesting is to look at the blue lines. The blue lines show black owned companies. That's where black South Africans are the majority owners, and you can see a sharp increase in the period 2016 and 2017. Local procurement, part of infrastructure is to make sure that we buy locally. We don't always get it right, and sometimes we get it embarrassingly wrong, but we're getting it right more and more. And so what we've done here is Treasury and DTI and EDD work together on tweaking the triple PFA to provide for the minister to designate products that must be manufactured locally when the state buys it. Here you see some infrastructure one, bus bodies, steel power pylons, solar water heaters, electricity meters, two-way radio terminals, fabricated structural steels and so on. There's a slide with some examples of factories, bus plants, truck factories, solar PV panels and so on that were opened. So I move on next on behalf of the management committee, Chair, to some of the other work that the PICC does. So it monitors more than 300 projects. It provides information from areas as diverse as economic data, project development and spending trends for each of these projects, and it provides this to Cabinet. It's got dashboards in a standardized format. It helps us to identify problems, Cabinet to monitor progress, and departments and state-owned companies to resolve blockages. If we take the case study of energy, this is one of a large number of areas that the PICC monitors. So let's first take the very big story. The first municipal electricity in South Africa was provided in 1892. Between 1892 and the onset of democracy, 5.2 million households were connected to the electricity grid. Since 1996, a further 9 million households were connected. So 5 million in more than 100 in 2 years, and 9 million in 20 years or so. Now, what is it that the PICC does? What is its day job? Its day job is to look at things like, we would look at what's our target in the medium-term strategic framework of new energy that we want to generate. In this case, the target would be something like 17,000 megawatts of new energy. Then we would look at, we would provide Cabinet with information like this that shows for each year from 2014 how many megawatts of new energy has actually been produced. In this little example that I've got, honorable members will see we had 1,600 megawatts in year one, and it grew as a cumulative figure, and we expect by the end of the period, at the end of 5 years, we would get to about 11,000 megawatts of energy. Let me compare it with how we've done previously. In the previous administration, we had 1,800 megawatts, so that would be a massive upscaling. But we also compared against our original target. We likely get to 62% of our original target. Now, in this case, there are very good reasons. We're now actually entering an energy surplus period. So the big dash to complete energy, it can be slowed down because energy demand is lower than energy supply at the moment. Then we break that down for cabinet into what is Eskom building. So we would provide the Eskom example of it. That's on slide 49. And then we'd say, now what does all of this energy build mean in layperson's terms? That 11,000 megawatts, not all of it is the same. Wind energy is different to coal energy because the wind don't always blow. So we do a conversion factor, a load factor. Based on that load factor, we're getting about, call it 6,000 megawatts of usable energy. It's the same as building a new Majuba power plant plus an Arnott and Grootvlei power station. Or it's the equivalent of building three Coburg nuclear power stations. But it's highly dispersed because you've got wind farms everywhere, solar plants, you've got your coal-fired power stations in different locations, you've got gas in different parts. But the cumulative effect is a dramatic increase in the level of energy that's coming into the system. Then we break it down into green energy, looking at how much of that energy is renewable. And then moving from energy generation, cabinet would look at transmission lines. So the PICC would look at the information on transmission lines, how many kilometers of transmission lines do we do each year. But then we also provide cabinet with an insight. In this case, Eskom's projection of transmission lines. So in 2010, Eskom said, by this year that we're in now, 2017, we would be at 16,000 kilometers of transmission lines. The next year they come and they do the new corporate plan or APP, and they would revise their numbers down for each year because it's now a rolling total. The effect of this is by the time you get to 2015, the original 16,000 megawatts, 16,000 kilometers of line has become just over 4,000 kilometers of line. Now we bring this to the attention of parliamentarians because this is where the portfolio oversight process helps the executive enormously by noting, because when these things are tabled, they're given opportunity to say, what's changed? Why are we changing this? Now, of course, the whole point of energy generation is so that someone uses the energy. So we track household connections, and in this period, we expect we may get as much as 1.2 million additional households connected to the energy grid by the end of this administration. I want to turn then, so we're not going to run through all the other things that we monitor, whether it's schools or clinics or transport systems or smartphone penetration in the society or broadband rollout or hospitals. Those are the other kind of areas that Cabinet expects the PICC to report on a regular basis. We're going to take a different example of the kind of work the PICC does. We would get a report on cable and metal theft that shows we're building new programs, but people are stealing the copper cable or vandalizing the train doors to sell it quickly to the scrap dealer, and so it renders all this massive infrastructure spend meaningless. So City of Joburg, for example, says half of their power outages are caused by cable theft. Of course, it's much deeper than that. It causes serious economic harm and disruption of services to communities. And the problem is that theft has always been treated as a petty offense. How much do you get for 10 meters of copper cable? Maybe you get 50 rand or 60 rand from the local scrapyard.
So it's regarded as a petty crime. But that can incapacitate an entire part of the city. It can close down a hospital. It can have an impact on the supply of water to a community. It has very, it can stop a train, a Gaut train or a metro rail train, and make hundreds or thousands of people late for work. So looking at this, the PICC then worked with the Minister of Justice, and we assisted that a Criminal Matters Amendment Bill be brought through Parliament that created a new offence, theft from public infrastructure, introduced minimum sentencing up to 20 years, makes it more difficult to obtain bail, and there's a subtle but important shift of proof to the possessor of copper cable. So just tightening up the ability of the law enforcement agencies to crack down. Two laws were amended, the Criminal Law Amendment Act and the Criminal Procedures Act, and we've also looked at the Secondhand Goods Act and restrictions on export of scrap metal. So as an example, officers of peace are now, the definition of officers of peace is extended to cover in specified areas municipal law enforcement agents, and we're piloting the national department is piloting with the city of Cape Town, and based on that experience we'll roll it out into other cities. So that's just an example. So it means the police alone don't have to do the work. Other agencies can enter and conduct searches and seizures of scrap metal. Trade measures. The Economic Development Ministry gazetted a trade policy directive in 2013 that's intended to place some controls on the export of scrap metal. It's had some success, as slide 61 shows, and hopefully it reduces the market for scrap metal. Let's take a few other challenges that the PICC deal with, and these are all not random, but they're specific examples of the kind of work. We would, for example, look at infrastructure spending in the period ahead. We would see here, as colleagues would see, a quite significant dip in spending 2016-17. Then we'd analyze that a big part of this, for example, would have been reduced spending by Transnet. Now, it's not that Transnet sits somewhere and says, look, we don't want to spend money. They've got a great plan to refurbish the rail line from Northern Cape to Saldanha to bring more iron ore out of the ground and ship it abroad. Suddenly iron ore prices soften, demand decreases, people want to buy fewer tons of iron ore. Transnet looks at this and says, we're not going to be able to raise the working capital in financial markets because there's no business case for a rapid expansion. Let's slow this down. Let's see whether the long trend line of iron ore changes over the next couple of years. Now, there's two arguments. So one argument is for Transnet to stay sustainable, it has to take market conditions into account. The other argument is sometimes you've got to invest ahead of the curve so that when the next commodity boom comes, you've got your train systems in place. And that's the kind of debate that we then have with a public entity to ensure that we lift the policy considerations. When we see this, we can share this kind of trend line in Cabinet as the PICC and with the Minister of Finance, and then see what, through a medium-term budget process or the normal budget process, what we do with this. Take urbanization as a challenge. The rate of urbanization or movement of people into urban areas across the countries is growing at an enormous rate. 375,000 new households are formed in urban areas in the main cities every year. But just think about that. That's an enormous number of new households. And so infrastructure has to play catch-up, and infrastructure has to shape that, because the weaker the rural infrastructure, the greater the push factor into the cities. So if you neglect rural infrastructure as we do to an astonishing extent, then of course you deepen the urbanization drive. And so in rural areas our big challenge is backlogs, in urban areas it's backlogs plus a massive increase in the number of people coming into the cities. And so our work in the PICC shows the impact of addressing backlogs in housing, water supply and electricity. Take the water challenge. Water shortages are due to both planning and climate challenges because water, like most infrastructure, there's a long gestation period between, as the city of Cape Town is discovering now, between the need and the decision to do something. You can decide today, but it will take you a long period to be able to build. And so a big part of water shortages is not only does it have an impact on the use by residents of water, but it also impacts on infrastructure build itself. We can't build massive new power stations without a major water supply nearby, as one example of the interrelationship between the different areas. We've pointed here to Gauteng's vulnerability to weak rainfall, exactly what has happened in Cape Town, which is an assumption that things will always be the best. You look at the best trend line, you hope for the best, you cross your fingers. Life isn't like that. Things happen, weather patterns change, a drought hits you, and our advice at the moment is we've got to look at Gauteng, that it can go through a similar thing if it is hit by significant changes in rainfall patterns over the next few years. Energy use. We would pull together work that has been done by different groupings, CSIR, Northwest University and so on, using different models of GDP growth, and it looks at the capacity of the grid, that's the top line, the black, the available capacity, even when you take into account that some plants are being maintained, others are decommissioned because they're very old. And then you look at the demand curve for energy, which is all the other lines. And what it shows us is on current projections, a range of groupings are saying to us we're going to have more energy than we can currently use for at least the next number of years to 2022. So this kind of pulling it all together is part of the work that the PICC does. Then we look at what we call leakages. There's a number of reasons for why money that we put into infrastructure leaks out of infrastructure. But first, we brought a top global expert from Oxford to South Africa to work with us on what is the international experience on cost overruns. And what they did was they sampled transportation infrastructure in 20 countries on 5 continents. 9 of the 10 projects had cost overruns. Then we did the same in rail, tunnels and bridges, roads, and so on. The point was not to say, look, we must live with cost overruns. That's not the point we want to draw from it. It's to say, unless government prioritizes planning, monitoring, and effective implementation, project costs invariably are higher than budgeted. And that knocks the fiscus, or it knocks users of infrastructure that has to pay higher prices for electricity or other trains or whatever. We do work on cost overruns in major infrastructure projects, so we've taken a couple of projects and looked at what was the budgeted cost versus the actual. We've looked at the use of imported components and materials in the infrastructure program because that's another leakage where money goes out of the system. We've looked at corruption, what impact does corruption have on infrastructure, and we've looked at disruptions when there's protest at the construction site and the construction site is down for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months, what impact it has. And these are some of the things that we can periodically come to the committee and share some of our insights into this. Taking corruption as an example, the point that the PICC has made repeatedly is that corruption has enormous impact. Fewer jobs in the economy, it has a negative impact on the fiscus, it dampens the economic stimulus that infrastructure is supposed to have, and it delays project implementation. and it can seriously erode the impact of additional spending on infrastructure, as well as our ability to raise funding for new projects. We did a simulation, an economic modeling exercise, that says if, as a result of corruption, or it could be any of the other factors, we overpay 10%, what is the impact on the economy? And the modeling showed that it can lead to a 27 billion rand loss in GDP annually, or an economy-wide loss of 76,000 jobs, which is why it's worth doing something about it. On asset management, the maintenance issue, in 2007, the Government Immovable Asset Management Act was passed, and more recently, it was reported in the media, the South African Institute of Civil Engineers released their periodic infrastructure report card for South Africa. They did one about, I guess, 11 years ago, and another one about 6 years ago. So it's 5 to 6 year duration where they basically look at the state of infrastructure. It's a very interesting report. 26 subsectors were assessed. They include areas like water, sanitation, roads, ports, and so on. And what it showed is, in the opinion of the civil engineers, one of the infrastructure areas has shown improvement, and 20 subsectors have remained the same, and 5 have dropped by a grade. And they point to poor maintenance as the essential challenge, the heart of the challenge. Now, they don't look completely at what the PICC look at. We look at new build. They look at the stock of existing infrastructure. But nonetheless, what they look at is a very important part of what we need to focus on, which is to get the best value out of our existing infrastructure. This slide makes the point very clear. It illustrates the cost to restore the condition of a road from a fair condition back to a good condition. And it says, if it's fair, and you want to transform it to good, you do about 100,000 rand per kilometer. If the same road, if you don't do anything, you allow it to deteriorate to a poor condition, then to move it back to a good condition would be 6 times more. If no maintenance is done, and the road is allowed to deteriorate to a very poor condition, the cost of moving it back to a fair condition or to a good condition would be 18 times higher. So what you think you save by postponing maintenance of a road comes back to hit the fiscus and the citizens. And this is just the direct cost. This is not the wear and tear of vehicles, the accidents that are caused, the loss of human life, all the other additional factors associated with it. So we've reviewed our state of maintenance, and it's clear the legal statutes and tools exist. They're there. It's not a gap in the law. The priority is to ensure that we don't prioritize new infrastructure over maintaining existing infrastructure. When people are when young children are in overcrowded schools, parents want you to build a new school. That's the popular demand. But if the existing school has been poorly maintained and you steal money from maintenance and you put it into building a new school, in the end you've got an extra 1,000 kids, but you have 20,000 kids in poor schooling conditions, which affects obviously the outcome of education. So of course, for a number of years, we're going to have this enormously difficult trade-off because we don't have enough resources to do everything that we want to do. But we're going to have to manage this better than we are currently doing it. That's why the Psyche report, we welcome the report. You know, here and there one can quibble with detail, but the general storyline is a fair storyline, that we're under-investing in maintenance and that we need to do a lot more in that area. And we put some specific ideas here, including ring fencing of funding for maintenance, which of course can take the form of conditional grants that are maintenance geared. We make the point that the funding of any project can't look only at build. Most of our funding proposals, people have only factored in the capital cost. So we've had, for example, in the past, a hospital finished built, but there's no money to employ personnel, nurses and doctors. So then for a year or a year and a half, the hospital stands empty as there's a fight between the municipality and the province, or the municipality and national treasury, to try to get money to stop. So it's getting the whole life cycle cost of infrastructure on the table. And of course, if I have a pet project that I want to do, I believe in this project, I don't want to make it sound very expensive. So the project promoters always have an incentive to dampen the cost. And so the PICC comes in, it has no operational responsibility. It can ask the difficult questions. It can say to the Minister of Economic Development, but hang on, your project that you're so keen on, where will the staff costs once you've got your project come from? Have you looked at maintenance? Maintenance will rise after the first 2, 3, 4 years. Some of the actions is to increase the spending trend line through work with National Treasury. So what Treasury announced this year, a few months ago, is a new budget facility to unlock the new project pipeline. And this, the importance here is the counter-cyclical role of infrastructure. The fact that infrastructure helps to avoid recessions and helps to counteract low economic growth. Urbanization, the challenge points to the importance of better use of our planning framework. And I'm advised that the chairperson of today's meeting has also set up a meeting tomorrow on the urbanization theme, the IUDF. And we have done quite a bit of work between the PICC and COCTA on the urbanization challenge. So the colleagues tomorrow will share some of that with members of parliament. Third, on water build, this can be a focus of future presentation to the committee, where we can look at areas of water, what our plans are, what the challenges are, how do we want to mitigate it. Energy build, we can come back to the committee similarly with further work being done on the energy use projections. Leakages, including corruption, overspending and imports, we're identifying measures now in the executive to further act against these, and these are all areas that from time to time we'd be able to share the detail of that. On maintenance, I've pointed to ring-fencing spending or budgets. But there's also the monitoring of spending on maintenance. If portfolio committees can support the efforts of executive authorities by asking the tough questions, including the questions in the NCOP, but also in the National Assembly, when entities come and pitch, whether it's an ESCOM or a Transnet or a TCTA or whatever, it's to draw the attention that Parliament wants to know how much you're spending on maintenance. How does it compare with the global norm? How does it compare with what you've done in the last 5 years? So that we all work together to shift the focus increasingly to maintenance. Cabinet's also looked at 21 possible projects, priority projects, covering water, energy, education, transport and health, that if we can unblock these projects, or at least as many of them as possible, they can increase the investment in infrastructure. They range from a new water pipeline, the Mokolo Crocodile Water Augmentation Project, to the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, acid mine drainage, and you see the other list, Clan William, Simvubu, and so. On energy, they range from transmission build to a coal IPP to solar water heaters, household electrification, and in a critical challenge. I gave a very good story about energy earlier, but if you had to ask what is the big weakness in energy, it's at the level of municipal distribution. The systems are old, they break down, they've not been properly maintained, so we're bringing massive new power on stream. We're a little bit weak on the transmission lines, we're not putting enough in there, and we're very weak in the endpoint distribution. And then again, we're very strong in connecting households to the national grid. On higher education, it's student accommodation in the two new universities. On transport, it's three key highways and development corridors. And in health, it's four key hospitals that have been identified. There's just a few pictures that we do lots of site visits as the PICC. We've done more than 100 site visits where we look at the desktop reports, but we also send staff members to have a look at what's happening, to look at the human story, how it's transforming lives, but also the problem. Sometimes an agency reports progress and we arrive and we see no progress. All of us think the project is properly underway. We get there, there's a community protest. Things are stuck because the community says no local labor is being used, so you're not going to move in this area. So it gives us good feedback that can then be shared with the SIP coordinators. Here you see, in this case, the construction of the R61 in the Eastern Cape. You'll see the station modernization in Gauteng, Pixlikaseme Hospital in Etiquini, the construction of a new runway at Somerset East Airfield. So a lot of this are outside of your main urban areas. We've decentralized a lot more. The Medupi Power Station in January, a school in Free State, a solar plant in Pofadder in the Northern Cape, fiber network rollout in Umlazi, student accommodation at Fort Hare, a senior school in Libodi, a public works and a road program in Limpopo. And that brings me to massifying jobs and infrastructure. Road construction and maintenance provide an immediate and high impact opportunity to scale up employment and provide incomes. So we're looking now as the PICC on ways of massifying infrastructure impact. Some work's been done on the Zimbabwe road maintenance model in KZN. It's mainly in the rural areas. It employs more than 40,000 people, mainly persons from women-headed households. So a family unit may get a kilometer of road that they must maintain, do the grading, cleaning of the road. The Eastern Cape has a similar program in place. And so using this as a case study, the question we're looking at is, can you replicate this model across the country? It provides about 3 days of work a week permanent. This is long-term work. It's not just 6 months. And the women then can do other things in the other days, plant, do agricultural activities and so on. So it's an interesting model of sustainable livelihoods in partnership with the state, and it covers two things, both improved maintenance and greater job creation. We're looking at financing systems. Parliament works on an annual appropriation framework, but infrastructure is essentially multi-year. In fact, many infrastructure programs are multi-administration. So we've looked, sat down with Treasury to see, can we have a funding model where appropriations begin to look at multi-year models. And the work's quite far advanced, but as soon as it's ready, then it will be announced by Cabinet or Treasury or the PICC or the President. We've looked at funding. You saw the announcement last year, the MTBBS, also the new facility that I've spoken about. We're looking at spending outside the state sector. So Telkom, for example, Vodacom, MTN, they do what is essentially public infrastructure, not publicly owned, but public infrastructure, which is your networks. So we're looking at how to boost that too. And we're looking at funding models, new funding models, to improve private sector participation. Technical capability in the state is an enormous challenge. And we don't want to downplay that, so we've made that a big focus. Cabinet mandated the PICC to establish a technical project management unit. Modest funding has been provided in this year's budget. A core team has been put in place, and we think that this can assist with project evaluation, cost-saving measures, and so on. Integration and coordination, we just provide there a little bit of feedback on the work of the SIPs and how they support the infrastructure programs. Private sector participation, we've identified 5 areas where the private sector is already very busy: energy, renewable, gas, and the two coal plants, telecoms, mobile and fixed, the private hospitals, private schools and colleges, and road building and maintenance where there are these concessions. Our challenge is to find the right model, to work out where is the state the best driver, where is the private sector the best driver, and where it is the private sector, how do we cut tough deals that protect the interests of the people? We're simply providing a private sector facility to have extraordinary returns is not helpful, because somebody must pay that, either the fiscus or the users. So it's just finding a model that's a competitive model that we bring everybody into the space. By way of very, very initial conclusions, Jefferson, the management committee felt that we should share with members of parliament this point we raised earlier. Infrastructure programs are multi-year and generally go beyond the term of one administration. Execution must be improved. We still have, even though we can tell many examples of good delivery, in almost every area there's scope for improvement. And so we don't want to be complacent. We want to embrace the fact that a lot more needs to be done. The National Infrastructure Plan is focusing us up to 2019, but frankly it's also going to be the template even for the next administration because of the long planning periods that involve infrastructure. So we've got to get more and more of it right. Parliament obviously plays already a key role. The portfolio committees are already the place where accountability of line departments and state-owned companies rests. A good area would be to focus much more in maintenance. The role of the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we could share with that committee through these regular engagements the broad spend trend lines that we're observing, because we get information much more quickly than it is publicly released, and we can also talk to them about the idea of ring fencing of maintenance spending. And then on the economic cluster committees, which is today's one, it's to look at the kind of model that the members of the committee would envisage building with a PICC. So we have a number of both management committee and secretariat members present, Chairperson, and they will be able to field many of the questions, I have no doubt. But they've asked that that we just do these remarks on behalf of the whole committee. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, Honourable Minister. It's quite a comprehensive presentation, focusing, of course, on the background of the PICC, where you come from, what you are, what you are doing, and also then the current projects with the challenges that are associated to improve the work of the Commission and the role of the legislature in that regard. Honourable Members, I also join to recognise then the presence of the Minister of Water and Sanitation and the Minister and Deputy Minister of Transport, who have joined the other colleagues in this meeting. I will now open up for a round of questions or input from members. Number one and number two. Number three is the Honourable Bengu. Number four, and then the Honourable Mandela will be five, and then I will take the other round. We'll continue after those first five, so that we don't lose the essence of those questions. Can you start with number one, please?
Thanks very much, Chair, and thank you, Minister, for your presentation. Minister, you mentioned the fact that the pattern of precipitation is changing.
Honourable Member, just before you continue, my apologies. Will you just say who you are so that when the executive responds, we know exactly who
you are. Exactly who I am. Yeah. Patrick Atkinson. Minister, you mentioned the fact that the patterns of precipitation are changing and that they're expecting Gauteng to have a drier period. Is the government looking at building new dams in areas where we do have better rainfall? Because I think part of the problem has been that a lot of our dams haven't necessarily been situated in the areas of best rainfall. So is there a look at potentially building new dams in areas where we do have better rainfall? Thank you.
Honourable Pultani.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks a lot for this eye-opening presentation. Just a few questions, dear Minister. Hopefully this will be understood. It's the first time I'm exposed to this kind of presentation information. Is there sufficient enabling legislation to enhance the success of this program? I've noted the few pieces that you have referred to in your presentation. And what socioeconomic results were identified that would, flow from this grant program, given that employment has not actually unemployment has not subsided? What potential risks were identified, and how were they to be circumvented? I can see that later you came across some, but when the program was conceptualized, what risks were there? Just a second, last chair. Why is energy still so expensive in the country? Where is the ruralization of this program? It doesn't seem to be there. And in fact, serving as I do in the Portfolio Committee for Rural Development, the results that we are getting from time to time, do not indicate that there is enough ruralization. I know that you spent some time, a slide or two, indicating that there's more urbanization than ruralization. But in reality, people in the rural areas would like to have a fair slice of the cake. The last one, Chair. What value of contracts has so far been awarded to black-owned construction companies? And I'm asking this question, Chair, because certainly as I do in the Portfolio Committee for Public Works, there seems to be a very, very thin number of black-owned companies that would qualify for this level of construction, your grade 8, your grade 9, and so on. And that's why I want to know the value. The numbers can mislead you. You can have so many getting, but in actual fact, the value can be, so small. And that's why I want to know what value has so far been awarded, which ties up with my original question as to the adverse socio-economic impact of this whole program. Thanks for the opportunity, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let me start by appreciating the presentation. My input relates to the Department of Small Business Development, taking into account that the NDP sets a target of 90% of 11 million new jobs by 2030, which is to be created by SMMEs and cooperatives. The question then that I would have is what will be the role of the Department of Small Business Development in the process? Or what has been proposed by the Department of Small Business Development in relation to this program, aligning it to the development of SMMEs and cooperatives, including their value chain? I'm asking this question because if 9.9 million new jobs are expected from small business by 2030, and there is this program of infrastructure development, surely the strategic plan and funding to the Department of Small Business should be in line with the role that the Department of Small Business would play to facilitate participation of SMMEs and cooperatives in this program for job creation purposes, but also for poverty reduction. That is the first question. The second question relates to ensuring that the implementation process of this program also takes into account the policies that are already in existence, which are saying 30% of goods and services will be procured from small businesses and cooperatives, meaning that if the target is the 375,000 houses, then 30% of that should be reinvested for development of small businesses and cooperatives. But it doesn't end with the ring fencing of that. It also requires adequate support systems that would enable SMMEs and cooperatives to take advantage of that market. Thirdly, the alignment now of providing the very same services to small businesses and cooperatives, because when a mall is developed, the whole infrastructure that is required, which is the road, water and sanitation, energy, telecommunication, will be provided. But when it is a small business, we don't see that infrastructure. It will be the small shop. Even if there was a road that is needed, the road will not be provided. If it is an agricultural project, if it is a project that is across a river, there will be no bridge provided. Creating a situation of the very same project not being able to reach its potential because the required infrastructure has not been provided to small business. So my question is, infrastructure development project for purposes of developing SMMEs and cooperatives by providing infrastructure that is required by them, and also participation of small businesses and cooperatives in accessing now the 30% that is set aside for them in terms of government policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I want to appreciate the presentation, but I'm also disappointed in a sense that in terms of apartheid infrastructure, it was to divide the nation. But our infrastructure must be able to unite the nation. So I didn't get that very clear. How are you going to unite the South African nation? Are you establishing new cities where national roads are not going to divide communities? Are you coming up with economic nodes that are going to ensure that people walk to workplaces? Are you going to ensure that transportation in those areas are accessible to everyone? I didn't get that very clear. So I think I have a problem with the whole arrangement. If we're still going to maintain the apartheid infrastructure, it means that we're not going to unite our communities. Secondly, the issue of rural development. If we are going to address rural development, it means that we're going to take our people back to arable land, and how are we going to do that in a very systematic way? And the issue of water harvesting, we're not addressing it. Are we sending people outside to go and learn how to harvest water, especially the rain part, where there are areas where we can harvest a lot of rain, like now? The rain is happening everywhere around the country. How are we harvesting the water? So what I can say, Minister, is that as long as we're not addressing, our planning is not based on our major policy of uniting the South African population, it means that we are still maintaining the apartheid infrastructure, enforcing the values that have always been there and oppressing our people. So I will not support that infrastructure, because it's a waste of money. If we really are not redressing the past, like the special framework, the way it is continuing, you can't continue. If you want to save on the maintenance of the tar roads, you can't continue building one-stand houses all over the city. because you'll have to build more tar roads into that city, and it's going to cost us even more, even to maintain that those tar roads. We're not talking about densifying or creating new cities where we will have smaller cities where we can be able to manage the infrastructure and ensure that we build more, we ensure that we build lesser roads and the economic activities are managed in such a way that they are useful for the South African economy. So we will still continue complaining throughout. So I would like us to have a different mindset that is going to ensure that South Africa becomes a united nation and ensure that the future of our children can never be reversed by whatever policy that we put in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Mandela.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Minister Fatel for the presentation put to us, just to gain clarity on number of questions. I'll put just five, Honourable Chair, through you. You know, the President in his State of the Nation address, His Excellency President Jacob Zuma, spoke and referred to the Umzimvubu Hydro Dam. Umzimvubu Hydro Dam, initially, the initial discussions emanate from the then apartheid regime in 1982. In a discussion over the years, over the regimes, even in the post-apartheid era, it's been the talk. But he spoke of this in the State of the Nation's address, and in 2014 went and attended a sword turning ceremony on site. I'd like to understand as to how far are we in actually realizing this project. Is it going to happen before 2019? Is it going into a 6th Parliament, 7th Parliament, or is it a 2013 vision aligned to NDP? Are we ever going to realize this? My second question is based on the Kai railway line. Speaking of railway line development, you know, I come from a remote village of Mvezo, 215 kilometers from East London. Villagers get on a train which takes them from Tata to East London. It takes 6 hours to get there. By car, it takes 2 hours. And if they are to run any errands in East London, it becomes a 2-day trip. This program has now been abandoned. I'd like to understand as to how are we ensuring that rural communities have proper, decent transportation means to ensure that they can get around our beautiful country. Third question is looking at higher education and training, and in terms of two new universities that are to be built and are envisioned in the near future. We have beautiful legacy institutions in the name of Forte University, the former University of Transkei, which has been bestowed a beautiful name, the Walter Sisulu University, after our very own architect of this young democracy. Yet these institutions are being left to rot and deteriorate. But in other areas, we see emphasis being put in maintaining other legacies in the name of the Mangosuthu Buthelezi University. I'd like to know what is being afforded to Forte and the Walter Sisulu University to ensure primarily the Walter Sisulu University is located in the former Transkei, a popularity dense area of the Eastern Cape, and it's the only institution that is located in that area in terms of higher education and training. On the fourth one, Honorable Chair, I've not even heard a word being mentioned in terms of our borderline. and our borderline is an emphasis of our sovereignty as South Africa. In most instances, it has totally collapsed. But if you look at the area of Limpopo, in the Musina area, there's even a defense base that has been located near the borderline, which themselves attest that they have only a capacity to monitor 10 kilometers of our borderline. About 250 kilometers of our borderline is left collapsed, opened to illegal immigrants. There are over 119 routes that are used in and out of our borderline, collapsing certain development nodes. And in my fifth and last, I'll make reference to the Musina development node, which, serving in the Portfolio Committee of Mineral Resources and Land Reform, we've come to know that in the Musina developmental node, there's emphasis on the precious metals that have now been overseen in the area. And this is soon to be dominated, as we are seeing today, with many illegals coming, particularly from Zimbabwe. And I wonder as to what are these developmental nodes being made if they are to benefit foreign illegals, because we are not maintaining our borderline. It's totally collapsed and there's no emphasis on ensuring that we rebuild it and ensure we have proper infrastructure on that. And I'd like to understand as to what will be done in that regard. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
No, thank you, Honourable Members. Before the Minister respond, may I just request the Honourable Fabs just to relieve me for a few minutes. It's just an important matter I must attend to outside. And then the Minister, you may respond.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the Honourable Members. Could I suggest that perhaps we could ask a number of members of the Management Committee and the Secretariat to also make some remarks, and if I may make a suggestion that perhaps Minister Nkwinti could make some remarks on the ruralization issues around infrastructure. Is he moonlights occasionally as the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform, and he may also want to talk about maybe not the detail of the Kai rail line, but the principal issues around access for rural communities to markets, to many of the social facilities that are required, because he also chairs SIP 3, which is in the deep rural areas of the Eastern Cape as well as the cities of the Eastern Cape. And we may then want to ask if Minister Mokonyane could follow Minister Nkwinti, because she's better able to give us the latest thinking on Honorable Atkinson's question on dam location, given changing patterns of rainfall, as well as the Msumbubu Dam, which Honorable Mandela, the concept has already been around since 1962, not even 1982, so it's even worse in that sense. But also the water harvesting question that Honorable Shawi was asking about. And then there were some questions, again Honorable Shawi asked questions about the role of infrastructure in uniting the nation, which is both to change the patterns of the past, but also to introduce opportunities for a unifying set of communities to arise. And Deputy Minister Nell, Deputy Minister of COGTA, is here today. I know that he will also be speaking tomorrow, or supporting tomorrow, a presentation on the IUDF, which has as its heart exactly this issue of how do we ensure a framework that gives effect to the values of a democratic South Africa and changes the patterns of the past. I think without us stealing the thunder of tomorrow, you may want to make a few, let's call it appetizers, to encourage Honorable Shawi to come tomorrow also to that discussion. And Deputy Minister Cronin has done a lot of work in the PICC in more than one portfolio, looking at the question of spatial imbalances, the role of infrastructure. He could talk through many of the issues in human settlements, transport, public works and so on, from an integrated point. And then we have the Minister of Transport here today and the Deputy Minister of Transport, and they too, that's quite a critical part of their mandate to look at how, in fact, a transport plan, a human settlements plan, a water plan, all of those different ones begin to address the legacies of the past. And then we have a few other members. We have the Deputy Minister, if you can
sorry,
develop
I missed
here.
That, the last one.
We have other colleagues also present from the Executive, the Deputy Minister of Economic Development this year, and I'm sure that he may also want to make some remarks on some of the other questions. And I'd encourage colleagues may have comments on questions outside of their direct mandate. They're all on the PICC structures. And if there's any questions left at the end, then I could see if I could give a crack.
Thank you very much, Minister Patel. So I think we all know the line of march. Fine. Minister Nkwenti.
Chair, thank you very much. I expected that line of thinking from the Honourable Fultan. He always catches us unaware at the committee. But the one of realization, I'm not going to respond to that by saying something. I'm going to give you my document. Just if there was anyone to do so, because you would be interested to seeing this.
Second.
Yeah, please.
Permission to cross the floor?
No.
Oh, okay, we're sending it to the official.
Now, you know, one of the important, I thought the Honorable Mandela would talk to this, he could do better. One of the things that that we appreciate is that in terms of realization, you know, one of the things is that when we constructed the bridge that joined two villages and more, in that place, Tumvezo, one of the things that happened as a result of that, the honourable member and the home, the big home there, they bought buses, and now buses can take people to Mtato or to Ikwe and so on, just because the road has been done, the bridge links. Then we intend leading, rather taking that through to Elodin or some, you know, towards the coast as well. So that's already there. I just thought the honourable member would speak to that. It's a beautiful story. Of realization. But there are quite a number of them there, Honorable Fulton. You will talk to that yourself, probably, if you have the time. Now, the policies, though, the 30% set aside, I think it's now compulsory. Any project from the 1st of April, actually, is compulsory for that. I think Honorable Member Patel can speak to this one. I want to skip that quickly. But the SMMEs and cooperatives, on Women's Day, but unfortunately women MPs were busy here in Parliament, we launched the what they call Mzansi Rural Women Cooperative. We have budgeted 1 million rands. They started the bank. They've paid already 100,000 rands to initiate that. That is now the CFI. We budgeted and we've got 1 million rands for them now. So they're going to have their own bank. Those are rural women cooperative. That's a rural women's cooperative bank now as we speak. We launched it here on Women's Day. They were here from all over the country. So these things are happening already. Maybe because we don't talk about them. that's perhaps the weakness. The youth is the same, the Narasek youngsters. We're busy finalizing their company now. These are rural youngsters, both boys and girls, if you want to use that. So we're finalizing that. It's the same thing. They're going to have their own rural cooperative bank. We budgeted 1 million rands for them, but we want them to do exactly what women have done in the cooperative, that they must pay the initial 100,000 rands themselves, so we can see the commitment there. I'm happy with the disappointment by the honourable member down there. The reason I'm happy with that is that we are busy right now, starting from, of course, from the governing party, discussing a program called Turning South Africa into a Construction Site, focusing on rural areas and townships. We've done an infrastructure master plan for that, so it's coming. It's going to come to all of us. We'll see how it works out. But it wants the purpose is exactly that of integrating South Africa. In other words, to do away, to kill the two wells, South Africa, one being rich and white, the other one being poor and black and unconnected. So that's the program now that the governing party is dealing with. I'm responsible for infrastructure there, so I'm talking about what has been given as a responsibility for me to do. So that's very advanced. As I say, master plan has been done. Now so I'm happy. Please, let's keep asking for that question. I don't remember there. The last one, arable land. I'm not sure whether this one speaks to more than just infrastructure. Of course, what I've just said now about turning South Africa into a construction speaks to infrastructure build. If you were to look at that, the document itself, it actually reflects South Africa. It actually makes you feel angry sometimes. It reflects South Africa as it is today, whether it's urban areas or rural areas. It shows the lack of that infrastructure that could integrate the two worlds in South Africa. So when we talk about arable land, government has decided, you see there were silos there. Those silos, if you go to Springbok Pond today in the northwest, Lichtenburg, you can see one very important example there. If you go in the Western Cape, you go to Witzenberg here. Now you can see some of the rural areas are typical rural areas, but others are rural towns, and we're focusing on all of those. So those silos which you saw there, if you were to go there, I invite honorable members to go there, because that's where we are building even warehouses. We want processing to happen there. We've already conducted the pilot, the first harvest, in that there. It's there now. Those silos have been renovated. They actually are what we're using. We may actually soon, the Honorable Bapela was talking to me this morning and saying we should actually launch it formally. So very soon we'll do that. He wants it to be launched before the end of November. That's speaking to that, because farmers, the reason we're doing that way is that we don't want white elephants. What we do, we make sure first that the farmers, the production sites are active. That's why we were able, during its first year last year, to harvest sunflower, to harvest other produce that they did there. So it's actually happening. The arable rural areas, the arable land in our rural areas is becoming active. But I might just say that the agri parks are the key to that, because all 44 districts in the country, they're busy as we speak now. Honorable members will probably look at your home. Three in Mpumalanga, honorable members from Mpumalanga, Bushbuck Ridge, Jace Morocco, and I can't remember the third one, but maybe honorable deputy minister might say which one. So those things are happening. Limpopo is also happening, Zanin. And so I can say a lot of the pictures, those pictures they are showing some of those. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. Minister Mokinyani.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members. The first question was around the new dam.
Yes, one of the things that has been a challenge in our country has been the construction of dams, not to store water, but to access water and distribute. And hence, we could not even have sufficient water during these last 4 years of the drought. The studies that have been done have actually indicated two interventions. One, it's about the creation of portable new storage capacities, alternative to the construction of dams. Secondly, it is about the raising of the dam walls of existing dams in view of the projections of sufficient rainfall. Because part of what is a challenge is that in many instances we rely on the fiscus to build these dams. You rather now invest on maintenance, the raising of the wall of the dam walls, and then the creation of portable storage capacity. And that's the focus now that is being attended to in our planning section. On water harvesting, part of what is coming out in terms of the new water strategy 3 of South Africa and the development of the master plan is to look at different options of dealing with water conservation in the country, and amongst others is water harvesting. And it depends on everybody, first in terms of individual behavior, making everyone here to make sure that you have the capacity to harvest water in your own area. Secondly, you make sure that you change the design. There's work already underway in the Department of Public Works looking at our own public buildings to actually put up all those the water harvesting solutions. It's only in the province of KwaZulu-Natal and other municipalities, a few municipalities in the Eastern Cape, where your giveaway houses actually come with the water containers that are actually fitted on the gutters around the houses. And I think part of what is of importance is for your own municipalities, because if it is at the level of the source, it has to do with articulation and access to water, that should actually be encouraged. Honourable members, the issue of Umzimbubu, what I can say is that it was moved beyond the 1962. I think what has now happened is that Cabinet had approved that it must be implemented in two stages, with phase one being the social infrastructure one, where you would be targeting the villages in terms of access to water, and that would be your Lalini Dam. And what we have been given now, we have been given an amount of 75 million to start the processes of clearing the site, as well as putting up facilities for those who are going to come and do the construction in the area. There is work underway in terms of consultation with traditional leaders and the transfer of the title deed. This matter we have raised also with Minister Nkwinti, because the ownership of land there rests with tribal authorities in the area. On phase two, we've done everything including the sourcing of alternative funding. The matter is now before National Treasury, the Department of Trade and Industry, ourselves and the Department of and the Presidency are championing that. And very soon we expect the Minister of Finance to issue a gazette on the approach that would be considered for the funding of phase two. And I think once those issues that are related to the funding model have been agreed upon, we will then be able to start putting together the Ntabela process also into place. The launch and all those things, I would rather not comment on them. We have now finally developed the designs and everything, and hence the agreement that let's have this thing in a two-phase approach, start with the Lalini, then come with the Ntabelanga thereafter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just let me announce. The Minister, Andries Nel.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Honourable members, just in relation to the question posed by the Honourable Patricia Chweo, as Minister Patel indicated, we will be doing a presentation tomorrow on the Integrated Urban Development Framework, which I think will deal with the issues of both urbanisation and dealing with the apartheid spatial legacy in a lot more depth. But maybe just to raise 10 broad points. I think the first thing is that South Africa sits with a challenge that we're already a very urban society. 66% of South Africans are living in urban areas. By 2050, about 80% of South Africans are going to be living in urban areas. Second point to make is that urbanization in South Africa is not equal to metros and big cities. In fact, some of the fastest urbanizing areas in South Africa are your small and your medium-sized towns and cities. If you look at an area like Bushbuckridge, for example, everyone would accept it as a rural area. But the reality is that it has more people and a greater population density than Mohale City in Gauteng. So, and also you find that in a lot of areas under traditional authorities, there's a tremendous levels of development and densification taking place. So when we talk about managing urbanization, it's not a metro issue. Related to that is that urban development and rural development for us are inextricably linked. You can't talk about the one and not the other. So the notion that we should somehow do rural development to slow down urbanization for us is just a false starting point. The issue is how do you manage those two things together? Because you need strong urban areas in order to have viable and strong rural areas and vice versa. The fourth point is that all of that is taking place in the context of a very painful apartheid spatial legacy, both at a macro level and that up to today still, all of your indices of multiple deprivation coincide to a very, very large extent with the boundaries of the former homelands. But even within our cities and towns, those were fragmented, and the reality is that much as we've achieved huge successes with service delivery and the rollout of infrastructure in particular, a lot of that has taken place on the peripheries of our towns and cities, and it's reinforced some of those patterns, so that 23 years it's almost more difficult to deal with some of those issues than it was earlier. So for that reason, the National Development Plan dedicates a whole chapter 8, to integrated human settlements and transforming the national space economy. The Integrated Urban Development Framework exactly elaborates and builds upon that and tries to set out a framework within which to manage urbanization but also to overcome the apartheid spatial legacy. Tomorrow, I mean, we'll go into much more detail around the 9 key policy levers of that integrated urban development framework and what work concretely is being done both in metros as well as your intermediary cities to deal with those issues. Seventh point is just to emphasize the importance of integrated planning and implementation, because very often that's where things break down. That we've gone a long way, but still, even where we identify priorities together, we still retreat into our silos to plan and to implement. And that's what's one, leading to blockages, but two, you're not going to overcome apartheid spatial patterns by working in that way. So we've got to sharpen on that. The eighth point is that for us there's an inextricable link also between implementing the Integrated Urban Development Framework
and a successful implementation of the back to basics approach of strengthening our municipalities, because you need strong and viable municipalities to be able to plan and to implement in ways that help to reverse those apartheid spatial patterns. The ninth point, I think Minister Patel might have touched upon it in his presentation, but I think two PICC council meetings ago, the bigger part of the PICC council was dedicated to urbanization and to spatial justice. And so the decision that were taken was that we should take the IUDF as a guiding policy framework in a number of the spatial SIPs that might have been covered in the presentation. So we'll elaborate on that as well tomorrow. And lastly, I think it's just the question of the role of Parliament and of parliamentary committees. In how does Parliament go about its work in having a much higher consciousness around issues of spatial justice in everything that we do, and in exercising your oversight committee, exercising your oversight responsibility, both as individual portfolio committees but as clusters? How do we put those issues on the agenda so that as you engage with departments, you're doing so in a way that encourages those departments to work together even more closely? Thanks.
Thank you, Minister. We then move on to yourself, Minister Cronin.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I won't go in the direction that Minister Patel was suggesting I go, because I think that Deputy Minister Nell has covered very well the critical questions that have been asked about how do we use infrastructure to transform the terrible legacy of apartheid space, which is still very much alive, I think. He's touched in broad terms, but just to assure you that certainly from within the PICC, we seek to integrate the presentation that was made, will be made tomorrow, and how we approach the whole infrastructure space. I thought, Chairperson, what I would do is just quickly relate mainly to some issues that the Honourable Bengu was raising, but also connected to one of the issues that the Honourable Fultani was raising. First of all, you asked the question, and I'm not sure, I think Minister Patel may or may not be able to answer the question, but how much of the big grade 8 and grade 9 type construction has gone to black-owned or largely black-owned companies and so on. I'm not sure if we can give a response to that. But what we can say is that clearly what we've highlighted by the very nature of a high-level summary of what we're doing or view of what we're doing has obviously highlighted the big things by and large, the big build operations and so forth. And typically those do require to be led at the very least by grade 8 and grade 9 construction companies and so on. And we know that overwhelmingly they have been white dominated and white owned, including the professions within them. And so I think it would be useful for Mr. One of the things that the PICC has done was to say when the collusion was detected in terms of the 2010 build and so forth, as from the PICC side, we said, look, it's not good enough that they just get fined by the Competition Commission. That must proceed. But we must also use the space now to force transformation. And Minister Patel will be able to provide, or Minister Nkriti, who were very active in that space. And there's some interesting stuff that has happened in which we're trying to build black-owned construction companies which are, have grade 8 and grade 9 accreditation. Grading and so on. But then I wanted to move on, it's related a little bit, so that obviously even if it's a big Murray and Roberts or whatever that is building or is the lead constructor, the contractor in a company, there's lots and lots of business, first of all construction business, but then also ancillary services and so on. And lots of work we spend in the PIC in identifying why are there blockages. Why are there problems in implementation? And one of those which we've highlighted has been the absence of social facilitation. So Murray and Roberts or whatever, Group 5 and so, go into a project, okay, and they do so as engineers, and that's what they are. And we as the public sector are not ensuring sufficiently that there's effective consultation, localization not just in the South African sense, but in the very local localization, and that there is job creation in the places where these things are happening. And as a result of the lack of that, there's a sense of, in the Eastern Cape, we often encounter this, for instance, to take that example, of people saying a road is being built, or a hospital or clinic is being built, but the construction company comes from Gauteng, all the professionals come from Gauteng and so on, and so there's then often what happens is protests, and the communities then block the site, occupy the site or whatever, and for months sometimes we get stuck. So it's not just doing the good thing by consulting likely, it's the right thing to do to create local possibilities, local construction, and consultation with local communities, and ensure that there's training, development of small constructors, development of other kinds of SMMEs and co-ops where a big construction is happening. Then let me give an example. Well, the next point I would want to make is that the emphasis that Minister Patel was placing on maintenance, okay, is a good one for SMMEs and co-ops, because often if it's building a bridge or something like that, clearly you would need a grade 9 or grade 8 company, hopefully blackly owned, but not always, to be the lead contractor. But in maintenance, often that is something that is ongoing. It's local. It doesn't require someone coming in from Gauteng or wherever if you can't find someone locally. And it's ongoing and can be done very often using local SMMEs and co-ops and so forth. And then I want to link that to the Zibambele program, which I think the Honourable Bengu is familiar with, coming from, because it's the KZN program. That's been going since 2007. Okay, and it's a program where 40,000 mainly women-headed households are contracted on an annual basis, which tends to be renewed, to look after a stretch of nearby roads. So there's no transport costs involved and so on. And they have a responsibility looking after something like, it depends on the topography of the road, something like half a kilometre or a kilometre of a local road, clearing the verges. It's rural roads that are otherwise hardly ever maintained, but it's looking after stormwater drains, the verges, basic things like that, and basic pothole repairs and so forth. And it's not for 3 days, Minister Patel, but for 2 days a week, and they get paid an EPWP-type stipend. So there's 40,000 of those, in fact 48,000 if you include Etiquini, of those households doing that work, getting a small amount of money for 2 days a week. There's a further 40,000 in the Eastern Cape. There's something like 11,000 in Limpopo, and we really want Northwest and some of the other more rural provinces also to move much more energetically in this space. Now what's interesting is that these households are typically also getting, if we identify the poorest households, we ask the community to help us. What is interesting about that is that those households are also getting other forms of income flow, child support grants and things like that. And in large numbers, Honourable Bengu, what we're finding is that the women, of course, it's largely women, they set up savings clubs, savings co-ops, and in some of the cases in Zimbabwe, they set up sewing clubs using the money that they've saved, and they've used the sewing clubs to produce reflective uniforms for the work that they're doing on the roads. So you're getting a lovely, lovely connection. And the point one's wanting to make is that one of the things, I know Honourable Bengu is absolutely passionate and has been consistently for many years on co-ops and SMMEs, that one of the interesting things that we're finding from Stats SA is that they're monitoring the durability, the sustainability of co-ops and SMMEs. And what we're finding is that those that emerge out of EPWP-type programs, in other words, where they're exposed to work experience and working together, and then on the basis of that set up one or another kind of co-op or SMME, their survival rate seems to be much, much better than SMMEs that we go and fund because someone has a bright idea, but they have no collective experience and work experience and so on. And the very last point I want to make, because it relates also to the solar water heater rollout. Okay. Now, we It's been delayed for a number of reasons because we're trying to improve the localization of the manufacturing of the things. But we are saying that what we want to do is the rollout of tens of thousands and eventually hundreds and eventually a million solar water heaters. We want to do that through an expanded works program type approach where we train people in installation in plumbing skills and electricity skills. But while they're in training, we want to then, and we're working closely with the small business development department, we want then to also enable them to set themselves up, to prepare them to set up as co-ops, so that we know that once solar water heaters are installed, they can be quite sensitive. A hailstorm comes along or a heavy wind and the thing gets knocked out of thing. And we then don't have the local capacity. So if we train people in installation, and then they develop local maintenance, for instance, co-ops, that creates an interesting pipeline of development. So that's just one example, Chairperson, of how we're trying to approach the interconnection between, it's not the only one, but the interconnection between the big infrastructure rollout programs and how we assist the development and sustainability of co-ops and SMEs.
I'll come back to you now, Honourable Bengu. Let me just give an opportunity to the Deputy Speaker.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask, and let me add my appreciation to what you correctly described as a comprehensive report. This is comprehensive. And I hope that we can find another way of communicating it in bits so that it's digestible to a variety of different audiences. I think this is part of what I think needs to be done. My question relates to the ICT. I would really like just the latest developments around your observation of this area. I don't know why I suspect it's one of those areas in our country represents one of those areas of vulnerability, new vulnerabilities, given the fourth industrial revolution. Some of the things that are happening, global companies and the impact, the effect they have, the data they control, that might even undermine the authority of certain structures of governance in our country. So what kind of work and what progress is being handled around these issues? And coordinate. The PICC is a fascinating example of what can work well when government coordinates and integrates its work. The potential impact is huge. So this is one area. I want to ask another question. This is it's also related to this thing in some ways. For example, I know that this work has been done in this area of the hierarchy of critical skills. What sort of progress is being made around this area? And Honorable Cronin just left. He answered partly the question of the lessons arising from public engagement. As firstly, in the development of ideas, but as adding to monitoring by the public, but also in other forms as well of engagement of the public. In infrastructure generally. What are the lessons that are coming out of the practice so far? Finally, greening the economy is one way of expressing part of a consensus we have as a country about greening generally. And so the rehabilitation of rivers, for example, Minister of Water there, dealing with alliances and so on. It looks like there's work that's been done here by organizations like the WWF and others who operate in this environment. This is another area in which public engagement might be very interesting, but this idea is often underestimated for its impact if done well, rehabilitation of rivers. It's linked also, for example, to harvesting water. So that's a comment that I'm interested in, but also to suggest that the work about greening the economy is also about much more
tightly managing all economic activities to be ecological in their effect, finally. I mean, without putting what they call extraordinary additional problems on the problem. Thank you very much.
I'm taking the last round of inputs and questions now, then I'll ask the members of the executive then to respond. Let me recognize those who have not asked any question here. The Honourable Masepo, followed by the Honourable Chairperson of Appropriations, Honourable Posa, then we have the WIP there, and then we'll have the Honourable Gwenya Mbila, followed by Mashila, then Sis Ruth, and then the Honourable Mandela. In that order, please. And then Honourable Fultane. Right? And can we keep it to the point, because we are encroaching on some of the study group activities that is happening very, very soon. Honourable Masepo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Minister, for the presentation. I would have also expected part of this, that research and development be part of, because it impacts in all these departments, in everything that we do, and also in your conclusion, talking about the role of portfolio committees also to also measure what other countries are doing. I mean, in that area of research and development, of which the NDP says we should work towards at least achieving 1.5 of the GDP for R&D, and we're only sitting at 0.73. We're far from 1.5. Other countries are on that we're trying to compete with in areas like the FKA, 3.6 or so. But secondly, it was the issue that were raised by this Honourable Bengu on the issues of small business and trade and industry. When you look at some of the things that are done, especially by blacks and young people and women that are incubated by CSIR, the kind of stuff that they do, when CSIR is done, they don't have a market or who to help. And one would look at small business so that they are marketed and promoted, and then if they grow bigger, then trade and industry to take over. In the expo that we visited as a committee of science and technology some 3 weeks ago, there was a guy, Honorable Minister Mukonyane, who was funded by the technology agency, who designed a catchment water, rainwater catchment, and it's rooted to ensure that we don't use clean water for flushing, and something that we've been talking about, but that rainwater that is being captured, it goes back. But then he's stuck, he doesn't know where to go, doesn't know who can help. Tia has done his best, he has produced these things. So I think it is important to work in partnership with such the CSIR and stuff like that, and to improve on the issues of infrastructure development. On the issue of the involvement, I won't be long, Chair, of the private sector, I think we need to intensify that, the partnership and its involvement, and I think also the use of South African National Defence Force. They've got skills there, water purification, you name it, and they are underutilized. And lastly, Chair, it's on the, you spoke, the issue of this cable theft. I think it is an important thing that you need to intensify. and we're talking here of minimum sentence. I think those people disorganize and inconvenience us and the whole country. We cannot be talking of minimum sentences. It must impose harsh sentences. Probably it should be one of those offenses that are unbailable, so that then we send a strong message, because we keep on using the funds that are budgeted for something else to create what was already there. I'll leave the others check because of time. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Kobaza. Or is it Honourable Posa? I think the Honourable Posa first. Kobaza.
Thank you, Jefferson. Let me start with the question that has already been raised, not as a question, but as a request, on the issue of the SMMEs and cooperatives. This is how we want to put it in our committee, and we always do this. Honourable Minister Patel and Honourable Ngwindi, I'm sure I speak for all the committees here when I say that we request a breakdown of the SMME cooperatives' participation in the whole of the infrastructure build project. A breakdown in terms of the numbers that are already participating, in other words, active SMMEs and cooperatives, in terms of their profile, women, youth, people with disability, and the urban rural representation. The rand value of all that active participation of SMMEs and cooperatives, it may come in the form of an annual kind of report, or a report over the MTF, over the 3-year cycle. But it would be very helpful to track that kind of information. Also, we would like to see the extent of skills transfer to the SMMEs and cooperatives, and so that you track how these cooperatives and SMMEs graduate to new grades, CIPD grades. But also, because that is also going to be critical in maintaining this infrastructure, we always say, take the jobs to the communities and keep them communities, and the money to the communities and keep those there in the form of building new infrastructure and maintaining the existing infrastructure using the skills that have been transferred. And of course, lastly, the jobs, which I think you have spoken about. So this is the kind of package we are looking for when we talk about cooperatives and SMEs. That's the first one. The second, Chair, you know that there are several budgets that are flying about. First, there is the national budget for infrastructure. Whether you are talking 827 billion rand or 1 trillion rand and so on and so on, at some point there was 300 billion rand at Transnet, whose mandate was to rebuild the freight infrastructure. There has been 59 billion rand at PRASA, and there are new monies being allocated to these SOEs. The billions of monies being in ESCOM, for instance, for their own energy infrastructure, etc., and so on. Can we have a complete breakdown of all these funds and how each one of them relate to the work of the PICC and the line function departments to which these SOEs should actually be reporting, so that you have a complete coordination of infrastructure project and the budget that are there, so that you don't have SOEs doing whatever they want to do or not doing anything at all, or very little. That's the second thing that we would like to speak to. And I'm quoting just these three. There may be many others. There may be a few others who have budgets of their own, but involved in infrastructure as well. The third issue, Chairperson, is the integrated planning where government infrastructure is concerned. When, for instance, you are building government facilities like health and educational facilities, where you find a clinic or hospital being built, no access road, no water, no electricity. We saw this about 4 weeks ago in Joville, where the money that was supposed to build the clinic had to be diverted to build an access road. And it was the same thing in the Eastern Cape with the ACIDI project. So that kind of integration, if we could speak to that, related to that is the role, for instance, of the Office of the Chief Financial Procurement Officer, who is also involved in procurement, including infrastructure, and now you are talking about the. In fact, it's not the first time. We have already heard about the National Treasury infrastructure facility, something like that. So the whole coordination around the structures that are involved, some new, like the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer and the National Treasury infrastructure facility and so on, some already established. So that we have an idea of who plays the management and oversight role, just in terms of government. I'm not talking about parliament. Lastly, Chairperson,
honourable members, we are pressed for time because the members of the executive who are here also have other obligations towards study groups. So may I request you, since this is our first interaction, that we will give the way forward, Minister Patel, at the end, but for those who are going to make interventions, just to keep it brief so that we can also release the members of the executive. There will be other and we will propose an approach on how to deal with these matters. But can we just keep it brief, please?
Okay. I'll try and be very brief. I just want to find out, thank you, Honourable Minister, for the insightful presentation. I just want to find out if you now have the 20 years infrastructure planning framework in place, but also on your monitoring of SIPs. I see on SIP 14, you have left out three new TVET colleges. Initially, the president, at the beginning of the MTSF period, let me say the beginning of this term, the president announced 12 TVET colleges, but I see that that has since been revised to three new TVET colleges. So I just want to check on whether it was by
omission or by mistake that you left it out, but also in your monitoring and evaluation, what came up from your presentation is that you do quarterly monitoring and evaluation reports. Now, I'd like to find out if it is possible to share those reports with us so that we can use them to strengthen the oversight, particularly on infrastructure development. Thank you.
The next intervention was the Honourable Gwenyam Bira.
Thank you very much, Shepherdson. Number one is the issue of the Mloto development corridor. This issue has been in our books, I think, from 1990s to date. Maybe if we can just get some highlights on what are the hiccups with regards to the delay in the implementation of this project. Then the second one, while the minister was talking about black economic empowerment, what came into my mind was the issue of the frontier. What plans have we put in place to ensure that really black people benefit, especially out of these big companies, because they used to front. At the end of the day, there's no difference. You know, we're just seeing it because that Phumzile Ngwenya is a shareholder, while at the end of the day, there's nothing that I'm benefiting from that company. Then the other one is the issue of the, I understand that PICC monitors the executive and the implementation of this plan, but what systems have been put, especially at the local level and provincial level, because that is where the small businesses and the co-ops are, to make sure that they get the stake of 50% out of the benefit out of all the developments that are taking place. For instance, in rural areas, we find that there are lots of brick making, small business people. But at the end of the day, how can we best assist them to comply with the SABS requirements so that when the school is being built in that particular area or a clinic, those people benefit out of those projects. They buy bricks and this, what do they call it, columns. There are lots of people in rural areas now doing the columns, bricks, and whatever. How can we make sure that when the school is being built, those people who are building the contractor can be able to buy the bricks from the local people? It's true that the lack of infrastructure deprives especially rural people basic services. For instance, in rural areas, we don't have doctors and nurses because they will tell you that there's no accommodation, there's no school for our, you know, for our children. There's poor roads conditions are in a poor state. At the end of the day, the poor infrastructure will deprive rural people basic services. Honorable Minister, you talk about the challenge with regards to the cable theft, but I think I don't know whether the others are also part of this, because you know nowadays you find people burning the trains, destroying our roads, burning the schools. Are they part of this, of what you have presented here, that they need to get a harsher sentence because, you know, their actions, you know, they brought us back. The other thing is the issue of development in rural areas. It's true, rural areas are underdeveloped. When you compare the rural and urban areas, there's a difference. How do we make sure that the CRDP, which was introduced to coordinate or to ensure integrated development approach in rural areas, becomes a reality? That when, because the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform is a catalyst or the facilitator of the CRDP, meaning that other departments have to just come in so that when there's a development in rural area, we provide houses, water, you know, clinics. There's an integrated approach in developing rural areas. The other one, the last one, I think we have good plans which are aimed at bettering the lives of the people. But my worry is that some of the plans, the resources are not talking to the plans. That is why there's a delay in the implementation of some of our plans, because we plan, then we don't allocate resources, then the plan will become a plan, forever. There will be no implementation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honorable Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the very enlightening input. I don't want to make a question. I just want to appreciate, Minister, that you said you would like to share on an ongoing basis the information you have with the Standing Committee on Appropriation, because I think that will be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I also appreciate the information which was given by both Honorable Quinty and Honorable Cronin. I, however, think that the responses that were given do not address the questions that I was raising. I just want to give a little bit of a picture. By 2009, there were 22,619 cooperatives registered in South Africa. There is a report which was produced by DTI then, indicating that out of those, only 12% survived, and there was 88% mortality rate. The services that were provided then, resulting to that picture, are still the same that are provided by the Department of Small Business Development, irrespective of the fact that the mandate of the department has been broadened. There are policies that have been put in place, like the 30% procurement and all those support policies that are related to opening the market. Then, in terms of sectors, construction sector, which relates to the infrastructure, there's 84% failure rate and 16% survival. Agriculture, 89% failure rate, 11% for survival. Transport, 94% failure rate, 6% survival. Manufacturing, 87.5%, 12.5% survival. Financial, 85% and 15% survival. So the question here is not about whether there are cooperatives that have been established. The question is, having established those cooperatives, how many of them are surviving and how many of them are dying? And what is the integrated development approach that is used, which aligns the development of cooperatives to service delivery programs? And that is the gist of the question. So my question is more about the input made by the Department of Small Business to this PICC. For PICC to align development of cooperatives and SMMEs to the infrastructure development program. That is the first question. Taking into account that there is 30% procurement policy, but also there is a target of job creation that is expected from small businesses, which is 90% of 11 million new jobs that have to be created in South Africa by 2030. We are 13 years from that target today. The second issue is, the second question was, does the infrastructure development program take into consideration that the success of cooperatives and SMMEs also depends on the provision of the infrastructure? They are like big businesses. So those two questions for me are very, very fundamental. And also, I am not just asking that question out of blue. The Department of Small Business reports to the Portfolio Committee that I'm chairing, and the strategic plan of the department doesn't speak to what is being presented here. And it doesn't even attempt to follow the integrated development planning that happens at local government level, which would trigger other services from other departments that are required by SMMEs. I know that I ask difficult questions when it comes to small businesses and cooperatives because my training background is community development. I am not expecting the answers today. If there are no answers, I am saying go and think about it and find a way of ensuring that development of SMMEs and cooperatives is taken seriously and the resources that are provided there are adequate enough to enable small businesses and cooperatives to provide the kind of job that are expected from them by 2030. I know about the Zimbabwe. What will not be said here is that how much those people earn, 300 rand. And will we be able to take them out of the indigent register and the social grant register when they are earning 300 rand? No. So let us be realistic here and talk about development of SMMEs and cooperatives as them having a value to add in poverty reduction and decent job creation. Thank you.
Honorable Mandela, you had a follow-up question.
Not when you came in, having been handed over by Honorable Favs, I thought the Honorable Minister Patel was going to be answering questions, but you seemingly went straight to take other round of questions without the...
Okay, we'll give the Minister the opportunity to respond at the end comprehensively to the questions.
What I was then raising is that my questions were not answered. But in terms of the Mzimvubu hydro dam, we have heard before the issue of clearing up of bushes and consultation. What I really want to know through you, Honorable Chair, is when is construction starting? Is it going to be a realization of this fifth administration up to 2019? Or is it being put to medium term, probably to sixth administration or seventh administration? Or is it something we are aligning to the NDP to be realized in 2030? I just want to know if this is a dam that will be realized in our lifetime. Honorable Minister has actually corrected me. It's not 1982, it's actual fact 1962. So I just want to really understand if are we really going to ever realize Mzimvubu Hydro Dam in our lifetime. But my other questions, I still look to your guidance, Honorable Chair. They've still not been answered. Thank you.
Honorable Kotani.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just three questions that were not answered. First one was on legislation, whether we have got sufficient legislation to make this happen. The second one was on the envisaged socio-economic impact when this program was conceptualized. And then lastly was why is energy still so expensive in South Africa, such that small businesses can hardly, you know, thrive. Thank you.
Honourable Fobbs, just briefly so that we can get the response.
Very brief. The issue of maintenance was brought up, and certainly one would agree. But the question I have is sometimes it's around the project, the funds being there, etc., the project half built, and at which point it just stops. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, perhaps the dam issue is a similar one. Now, there are many, many of these in sort of supervised by municipalities, public works, and so on and so forth. And in my own area, there's a sort of clinic built that was condemned when it reached the final stages. So I think that that kind of issue in infrastructure needs to be looked at. It's a lot to do with the specifications that are on paper and the tender accepted, and then the specs not used. We need something done about that. The other issue is on the trading side and the transport side. the complementarity of trade in Africa, intra-African trade and industrialization. When it comes to rail, I understand that we have a narrow gauge rail and that this is not really the practice throughout Africa. Now, are we going to continue to be building this so that we can't interface? Do you follow? Or when do we stop or start? The last point is, again, on that issue. It's to do with Kumba iron ore, which is the longest rail internationally carrying only one commodity. I would hope that that kind of infrastructure would stop, that we try to combine a number of issues being used on such an expensive project. Not that that was built in our dispensation. Thank you.
Minister Patel, and then the team can respond.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think by way of a few perhaps more broader comments, this is the introductory session of an important engagement between the executive and the members of the legislature. So by the nature of this first session, I think we needed to pick a few examples to illustrate the kind of work the PICC does. And I think similarly, honorable members had a number of fairly specific questions. Perhaps reflecting on the way forward first, given the time that's available, we're not going to be able to deal comprehensively with all the questions. But I think it could perhaps help that we sit before the next engagement with the chair and select perhaps a theme for a given meeting. And then we make sure that the executive authorities covering that theme are also present, because they all are in the PICC, and so we coordinate the dates carefully. And that way we can systematically work through different things. So today, one of the themes that came out, a very important one from a number of different speakers, is the development impact of infrastructure, from quantifying it, to deepening it, to addressing fronting issues, all of to dealing with the socioeconomic goals and whether we've achieved it. All of those are very important areas. So we know that when we do an engagement February next year, that's the theme that we're going to cover, then we do the piece of work in infrastructure on that, and we bring that here, and the focus would then be on that. Similarly, directly and indirectly, a number of comments in some or other way deal with the skills issues. Honorable Mandela raised the issue of the support for existing educational institutions. In his case, he cited the Eastern Cape, but I'm sure he would also point to challenges elsewhere in the country around that. Other colleagues, Honorable Filtane, asks about some of the risks inherent in an infrastructure program, whether they were assessed, and how do we mitigate them. Some of those risks comes to skills issues. So if we have a theme dealing with a skills area, skills and innovation, skills and the knowledge economy, we can bring that piece of work together and perhaps have a more coherent engagement that would enable the honorable members when they leave to feel that there's been a solid piece of work that Parliament and the executive has engaged with, because we need to ensure that the honorable members at the end of this discussion feel that they've really impacted in the thinking of the executive, and that there isn't lots of little answers we've given, but it doesn't add up. So I think a thematic approach, rural infrastructure, for example, it deserves its moment in the sun, where we just come here, we deal with that issue in all of its complexity, the economic infrastructure in the rural areas, the social infrastructure, and we have the engagement on it. So that would be my suggestion, looking at the way forward. Minister Nkwinti always makes a very interesting point when we have engagements inside our structures. He says we need to constantly remind ourselves what the PICC is and what the PICC is not. because we won't take over the responsibility of a cabinet member or a department. But what we do is we provide to the executive authority, both that minister, the president, the premier, the mayor of a city, really usable and useful snapshots that can help them refine the way in which they implement. But implementation decisions, the spending of money, the timing of projects, those things are ultimately decisions that the executive authority and the accounting authority of an entity makes. Which also comes to the kind of areas that we may have the ability to influence and the ability to usefully share ideas with Parliament. Sometimes the minister of an area or the premier of a province would be much better equipped to deal with a detailed issue. Sometimes the PICC, when it's about integrating approaches, may be better suited to that. Having said that, on a few specific issues that have come up, on Honorable Filtani's question on the enabling legislation, I want to give a partial answer. I want to say I think we've got enough for now to get the job done. Our problem has never been lack of legislation or lack of policy. It's simply lack of implementation. Because as we implement, we think of a great idea and we get distracted. We follow the great idea. Just sometimes what it requires the PICC does is just stay focused and disciplined on the thing you're chasing, not add new things, important and attractive as they are, but just focus on implementing. And then as you get that done, you can bring a second issue in and a third issue in. So that's part of the approach. That we can think of better laws, but I think we're not even using the existing laws well. On the question of socioeconomic results, this last slide begins to hint at what the issues are. I would think we can only properly deal with Honorable Filtani's question and not give it a one-minute answer if we in fact have a focus on the development impact. The third area on risks and mitigation. We in fact have, I think, two or three slides that we did in 2012 on the risks with the infrastructure program as well as the mitigation. And then we did a heat map afterwards where we said what are the very hot risks. We gave it a red. And where are the ones that we can manage it, which was the green. So I think the risks are many. There were more than 20 risks. They varied from, for example, if we expand road building, will we have enough bitumen to use? So we needed to see what is the refinery capacity in South Africa. Is there an ability to import bitumen if the refinery capacity is lacking? So it was that level of detail. For example, we looked at an issue around overcharging on the infrastructure program. That made us put a lot of effort on the looking at collusion and cartels in the construction industry and trying to wipe that out so that you don't have massive costs being sucked out of the system to the damage of the public and with no benefit for ordinary South Africans. For example, we looked at the issue of quality control on infrastructure, that when you massify, will you have enough skilled personnel, quality control institutions, inspectorate and so on, and we put some measures in place. So periodically as we engage, we can perhaps share some of that, because it's a very, very important question that Honorable Filtani has asked. In fact, that question goes to the fundamental issue of planning. It's the ability to anticipate the risks and begin to deal with them. And Parliament needs to know that, because that's where Parliament can play a key role in giving us the legal and the resource envelope to ensure that we address the risks that we anticipate. Going to the issue of the price of energy, the quick answer, but there's a more detailed response we can give, goes in some way to the price of building a modern energy system. We ought to have built energy, your big power plants, on a more regular basis from the late 1980s onwards. But in the early storyline, what we identified, we said, as apartheid started to get into crisis, it shifted money to military, to the police, to security. And even the bold program they had developed, they were beginning to neglect. In democracy, our challenge in that first 10 years was so enormous, and there was a slide that set that out, that our ability to immediately grab and run with these areas wasn't there. Now we're playing catch-up not only on the underinvestment during apartheid, which was especially skewed, very, very discriminatory towards black South Africans, but also in the early phase of democracy, a lot of our infrastructure went into the house build and connecting people to existing bulk infrastructure. Now we've got to deal with the energy generation challenges, the dam building challenges, and so on. So I think that gives part of the answer. There's more detail that sits under that that we need to come back to and share in due course. On the questions that have come up, I mean, I think many of the questions require, when we deal with a skills issue, then we can properly deal with Honorable Mandela's important question, and I think the same goes for many of the questions that have come up. But I do think that the Deputy Speaker asks quite an interesting question on ICT. And the ICT issue, there's many dimensions to it. One problem is the cost of data, because data is the new economic passport in the 21st century. And when the costs are high, you're basically constraining South Africa's ability to play in the space. It's not just young people who can't use social media because of high costs. It's also core economic activities that are undermined, and the ability of young people to generate fresh entrepreneurial opportunities. So we've now announced a market inquiry into high data costs, where the Competition Commission will bring its capabilities into this area and examine what is the cause for high data costs. The second one is data access. When you have what is called the digital divide, where some are in the digital economy and others are excluded because they're in the rural areas or because they're in parts of townships with no Wi-Fi access, then you deepen the long-term inequities in the society. And so a big part of the fiber optic rollout and the free Wi-Fi is to address those kind of challenges. Honorable Deputy Speaker also raised deeper challenges, cybersecurity issues, which go not only to sovereignty but also to the privacy of information of individuals, medical information, other information. It's all beginning to be integrated in online systems. Your medical aid can now, at the press of a button, send your entire medical history to any doctor that is treating you. That creates new vulnerabilities in the system that would need to be dealt with. They go beyond infrastructure, but they raise an important role for Parliament, where Parliament sets the rules, in a sense, for society. There are competition issues. How do you regulate big data companies, your Googles and Facebooks and so on? South Africa don't have the capability. If we put a tough condition on Google, it can walk away from our market. The European Union is big enough. They've put a tough condition recently. Google can't walk away. So how do we combine regulators in the South, in developing countries, that our combined capability allows us to put appropriate regulation in place that can ensure that the big data companies' practices don't undermine economic development in developing countries? So those are very interesting questions. On the lessons of public engagement, one repeated issue that's coming up is the use of local labor and frustrations around that issue. The other big issue that's coming up is the displacement effect of infrastructure. It energizes but can also displace. The N3 highway from Durban to Joburg is a very good example. The engineers developed a new path for the highway that would save time, save costs, make it simpler, quicker, easier. The problem is it would have bypassed Harry Smith completely, and it would have rendered this entire town
a ghost town over time. And so the PICC had to step in. Rob Davies is the chair of SIP2. He then had to work with the Minister of Transport and the local communities and Free State provincial government to find a solution where, in fact, because it was community protest, COSATU had put a Section 77 notice even in. So that's an example of how we sometimes work with communities to try to find solutions where the planners and the engineers have not always been human sensitive. They've looked at the rands and sense it makes sense, but development is about more than just the rands and sense. It doesn't mean we can't look at the rands and sense, we must do that too, but it's that integrated approach that balances all of these. Jefferson, there's no way in which we can do justice to the interesting questions. R&D, I'd love to talk about that. And the things we're doing, for example, on R&D, new toilet systems that uses less water, where there's a young black entrepreneur that's developed this. Minister Mokonyane is backing this initiative. The IDC, Industrial Development Corporation, is backing this. So there are lots of interesting little innovations that we can come to. Maybe a future focus on skills, R&D, innovation could address those kind of things. The quarterly reports to Cabinet are classified documents. I think what we will do is to pull out key themes that we can share, but those documents themselves contain often very sensitive market information. But let's see, as we develop this forum, how we can empower members of parliament in the conduct of their very, very important work in development. So, Chair, what I've done is not to answer many questions, but what I have said is, the team here, the team of ministers and deputy ministers, are in fact, we like this kind of engagement. This helps to build new alliances and support for infrastructure that we need. And so we'll work with you, Chairperson, to develop a theme, a thematic approach, and then we can deal with it that way. So thank you very much on behalf of all my colleagues who are present here for the opportunity you've given us.
No, thank you, Honourable Minister, and thank you to the members of the Executive for this first step in terms of our interaction, and we will definitely work in terms of the themes. In the meantime, there are certain responsibilities, of course, that some of the committees must continue to pursue in their ordinary oversight work, and we will have a meeting with the chairpersons in the economics cluster to further process this. May I remind honourable members that tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock there is a briefing by Deputy Minister Andries Nel on the Integrated Urban Development Framework. Very important. A lot of the questions that was raised today also points towards that. What is happening in these urban areas in terms of urbanisation? And initially we did not include the committees in the economics cluster because of certain programs that are there tomorrow afternoon. There's been a few changes, and we invite the chairpersons and committees, all members of the economics cluster, to attend that. And we will ensure that we give justice to what will be discussed there. Honourable members, thank you for your participation, and the meeting stands adjourned.
And Chair, just in front of you, to fix that might be 500 rand. But if we can leave it to be broken until those blanks, it will mean that we need to design that, and we also need to design that it may come to 200,000. So that maintenance.